And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. When the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra hired Marin Alsop as its music director back in 2005, it made history by becoming the first major American orchestra to engage a woman as its artistic leader. There were and continue to be many female administrative leaders of American symphonies, and there are several more women who appear to be poised to take the artistic helm of large organizations in the next few years. But even the most casual and infrequent visitor to the Meyerhoff in Baltimore or the Music Center at Strathmore will notice that while there are a lot of women playing in the BSO, there is only one African-American member of the orchestra. She is Esther Mellon. She's a good buddy of mine. She's been a gifted member of the BSO cello section since the 1980s. And the BSO is not alone. Orchestras across the country, even in majority African-American cities like Baltimore, rarely have more than just a few people of color in their ensembles. My organization, the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, has fewer than 10 African-American singers in our chorus, and that number's more than 100. And our audience, like that of the BSO, is largely white. Erin Dworkin is the dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance at the University of Michigan. For years, he's been a leader and animating force behind efforts to connect people of color with jobs in the classical music business. He's in town to give a talk on the Dean's Symposium Series at the Peabody Institute this afternoon at 2:30, and he joins me now in Studio A. It's terrific to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
So the latest data that I've been able to put my hands on, and maybe you have more up-to-date data than me, is that it's under 2% of professional symphony players in the United States are people of color. Is there a sort of, you know, easy answer to the reasons for that?
Yeah, and actually the League of American Orchestras has just come out with some very, very recent, most updated survey data and basically combined in terms of blacks and Latinos, it's around 4%. But certainly African Americans under 2%, et cetera. And unfortunately, and this is kind of one of the interesting aspects to this, in the staffing of orchestras, there's actually been in certain areas a decrease. And there aren't all of
that's the administrative staff you're talking about.
Exactly, right, where there aren't some of these really structural challenges that do exist on stage. So it is not just an ongoing issue and a problem. But it is one that, unfortunately, despite the work of Sphinx and a host of other organizations, we've only moved the needle a little bit.
Tell folks about the Sphinx organization, an organization you founded. You are a violinist yourself, an African-American violinist, and you started the Sphinx organization specifically to elevate the profile of African-Americans and Hispanic players.
Yes, and absolutely biracial, violinist, and grew up initially in New York, but then Hershey, where I came down to Peabody Prep on Saturdays, studied with Pearl Sanofsky, and so I have some wonderful history here. I'm really excited to be here. But Sphinx works to really transform lives through the power of diversity in the arts, and does that through a host of programs. So in-school programs in school districts like Flint or Detroit, where there's very limited access, leadership programs like the Sphinx Competition, national competition, where the top winners go on to professional careers, solo with orchestras around the country. There's the Sphinx Virtuosi, which is the traveling ensemble currently on tour, and leadership awards like the Sphinx Medals of Excellence. So there's a host of different programs that Sphinx has so that it can really address these issues across the board. And now under the leadership of Afa, who is a longtime executive director and then took on the CEO role after I transitioned to Michigan over a year ago, they really are also looking at how to be a stronger catalyst, because the reality is Sphinx and the other organizations can and are having a profound direct impact, but the field itself must do this work. Orchestras themselves must do this work. And in my perspective now from schools of music, theater, and dance, performing arts institutions must do this work. So there is a huge responsibility, and I think Sphinx can definitely play a pivotal role as a catalyst.
Erin Dworkin is the dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan and the founder of the Sphinx organization. He was the recipient of a genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation back in 2005.
Actually, so, the same class as Marin.
As Marin also. That's right. That's right. You both got it at the same time. So what is the work? What do they need to do? What do the schools of music need to do? What do professional symphony orchestras need to do? What do boards of directors of orchestras around the country need to do?
So first, I would share that that we all collectively need to do something. And what I mean by that is overarching, and I'm going to get to some specifics, but too often, if you look at the majority of institutions and you say over the past 5 years, what have you financially invested in this issue and what actual action steps, operational changes, structural changes have you made to your institution as it relates to this issue? The answer is minimal or none. So just from a very simplistic standpoint, to bring about change, there must be an investment of time, of financial resources, and actual structural changes made at institutions. And that, for the most part, unfortunately, still is not happening. With that said, schools of the performing arts, we can obviously look at the way and the nature of how we do recruitment and how we do engagement with a variety of communities. And we've done a host of work with that, both not only at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance at Michigan, but also as a university as a whole. We have all been developing at the various schools at University of Michigan diversity, equity, and inclusion plans, which relate to our faculty, our staff, our student bodies, the climate that we have in our various school environments. So a host of different ways, and we are actively working on those. And this includes structural ways in terms of the way that we search and identify faculty, structural ways in terms of the schools and the regions and the way in which we do in community engagement to build our recruitment base. And also in terms of the community engagement work that we actually do in terms of programs, that as an institution, we train our students to be community ambassadors. We train them to be artist citizens. And so there's a host of ways there.
Is the pipeline getting any bigger? I mean, are there more available people in the pool of talent from which symphony orchestras across the country can choose than there used to be?
Yes. So absolutely, the pool is increasing. And just, for example, one statistic at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance ourselves, we had the largest single increase of underrepresented minorities in terms of not only applicants this year, but also in terms of actual students who have now enrolled and are in our freshman class at the school. Largest increase in the history of the school. So you can do this work and bring about changes and outcomes and results even in short periods of time. In terms of orchestras, there are a host of things that orchestras can and should be doing. Number one, of course, looking at their faculty and staff and boards, where decisions and aspects related to recruitment can take place on a relatively short time frame. Also looking at just literally their budgets and what percentage of their budget are they allocating towards this. Is diversity, equity, or inclusion a priority in their institution? And that is able to be determined by the percentage of their budget that they might apply towards these.
What
things.
Kind of things would they spend money on? In other words, how can you buy diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Right, exactly. So, and I would probably term it as investing in it because it is in the best interests of the institutions, but most importantly to our art form. So one, a number of orchestras, unfortunately too few, have done a variety of different fellowship programs where a musician of color may spend time in the orchestra, gain a lot of experience, and through that actually go on and win positions. But over time, what we found—
They often have those for conductors, but not so many times for players in the band.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that, unfortunately, is very, very incremental change because it's such a small number. And so there are a growing number of people who are looking and talking about the process that orchestras use as it relates to auditions. And should those aspects be revisited? And so that might include taking a variety of criteria into account. And so not just taking, if you will, this literally blind snapshot behind a screen, but say, are there more factors of a musician that we want to consider as we want to invite them into our orchestra?
And let's explain to folks how people audition to be in a major symphony orchestra these days. They come out and they are behind a screen. So the committee or the people who are judging what they're hearing are not seeing them. So and the people who say that we'd have more there are people who say we'd have more diversity if more people of color were winning these auditions, which are highly competitive. I mean, sometimes hundreds of people playing behind a screen for one or two spots in a violin section somewhere.
And that's it's exactly true. And the screen process has had a transformative effect on gender equity in American orchestras, and especially compared to a number of other countries around the world, we've really been able to have a transformative change. But
it lots has, more women than there used to be.
Exactly. But unfortunately, of course, that is not translated to people of color. And one of the things is that, as you described, it's incredibly competitive. You know, to give you an idea, an average for, you know, the selectivity of, you know, Ivy League schools is maybe about 8%. You know, Curtis, which is one of the most selective, the most selective college, is around 5%. But your odds of winning, as we say in the field, a position with a major symphony orchestra is half of 1%. So when we just take those numbers into account, the ability to build such a diversity in the overall pool of those candidates who are vying for those positions, the idea that orchestras look at the variety of skill sets that they want, of which the performance of specific repertoire is the top priority, but to say there's no other aspects, I think is important for us to think about and to debate and to dialogue about. One of the interesting things that a number of leaders in the field, not those who are focused on diversity, equity, or inclusion, but just leaders in the field, Tom Morris and Jesse Rosen, leader of the League of American Orchestras and others, and the New York Times has said, Jim Astrag said, is that the issues facing American orchestras and the best amongst American orchestras is not the level of excellence that they bring on stage. It is the growing homogeneity that we hear in terms of the sound. There is a reason why we play music. There is a reason why we engage in this incredible art form. And successful homogeneity is about as far from that goal as we can be. And so looking at that and identifying that there are additional criteria and aspects that we want to help fuel and inform our orchestras. And if I could just take one second to add too, because a big kind of opposition that a number of people share is they say, well, we don't want to do this because it will diminish the excellence, the artistic excellence.
They fear what they call quotas. You know, we can't say, oh, there's four spots reserved for African-American players. Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm definitely not in favor of quotas either, but I am in favor of developing additional criteria through which we actually want to build the great American orchestra. And with that, the idea that artistic excellence, if we want to perform the best Western European music to a primarily small subset of our regional community who are affluent and white, then we are doing a phenomenal job. We are excellent at that.
But yeah, if we got that licked.
Exactly. Yeah. But if we want to perform the greatest repertoire that exists with a broad breadth, and we want to perform and impact and touch and transform the breadth of our communities, then I would say we are not currently exemplifying excellence in our field.
So it is a matter of orchestras deciding that the homogeneity of what it looks like is just as important as what it may sound like. I mean, especially in a town like Baltimore, we had a terrible, you know, spate of violence and unrest a year and a half ago. And the symphony, you know, wanted to get it. Baltimore Symphony, I think, did everything they could to, you know, insert themselves into that conversation. But boy, it's difficult when nobody looks like the people that live in the city. Yeah,
absolutely. And it definitely is possible. There's, you know, people say, oh, is somehow our excellence will be diminished. And I say, I'm waiting for the news story about this major orchestra's artistic level has precipitously dropped because we brought too many people of color into the orchestra.
Aaron Dworkin is the dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance at the University of Michigan, the founder of the Sphinx Organization. He'll be speaking in about an hour and a half at the Peabody Institute at the Cohen Davison Family Theater over in Peabody. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate
it. Thanks so much. It was great.
That's it for us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow on Midday for a conversation with activist and educator DeRay McKesson and longtime civil rights advocate Ralph Moore. We'll talk about the connection between the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the Black Lives Matter movement. That's tomorrow at noon here on 88.1 WIPR. Lunch for our guests today provided by The Diz. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. midday.com. I'm Tom Hall. Really appreciate your making Midday part of your day. We will see you tomorrow. Here and Now is coming up next after a break for the news. Have a great day.